out here.
Oh, hell, really?
Yeah.
Navy V-12 program said, no, if they want you, they'll take you. So in July 1943, I got my letter from President Roosevelt that I had been drafted. And on the 31st of July of 1943, there were probably 40 fellows from the Grand were sent to Spokane by train. And interesting thing, that was the first train ride I'd ever had in my life. And we went up to Spokane and had physicals, and then were inducted into the Army. And then we were sent home for a month. And late August, I was sent to Fort Douglas, Utah, which is in Salt Lake City. And I took my IQ test and a physical, and I was sitting there waiting for results, and a sergeant came by and picked up my papers. Hey, you got really a good IQ. You could go into be a pilot. And I said, I don't want to be a pilot. He said, well, make you an officer. I said, I'll take it. So I went into, there were three of us from Union County, Don Ainsworth, who was from grade school through high school classmate, and I, he and I were two of the fellows that were picked for cadet program, and were sent on down to Santa Ana, or to, Amarillo, Texas, that's where I went, Amarillo, Texas, and were there for about 6 weeks basic training, I went to Missoula, Montana for 6 months college training, pre-flight in Santa Ana, California, and there you could buy your test scores, determine whether you're a pilot, navigator, or bombardier, and I chose to be a navigator because I really didn't want to be a pilot.
How closely were you paying attention to what was going on in the European War and the Japanese War?
Well, very, very, very close, because we would be sent to one or the other. And
were you doing this by reading newspaper accounts?
Well, probably just by radio, or we would have assemblies in which they would give us news reports.
How were you feeling about what was going on?
Well, one thing, and I think most young people do, I never once ever felt I would ever be killed. I knew I would probably be flying in bombers, but I never had once a fear of death or I can't remember just when Europe gave up. I think it was, can't remember. But anyway, it was just when I got in training, Hitler resigned. That was because he heard I was coming over there. So he quit, and just before I was to be sent to bomb Japan, Japan quit. So they knew I was going to be there in two more days. So that's why the war was, both wars ended.
Your confidence was fully justified.
Yeah,
then.
It was. Yeah. I look now at 18. I was just barely 18. I was 17 when I was drafted. Because I was 18.
Usually it's 18.
I was 18. I was almost 19. That's what it was, almost 19. Because I had my 19th birthday in Amarillo, Texas. And then I was 20 when I got my commission in January 5th of 1945. And didn't become 21 until a month before I got out of service, so I was 20. But I look at 20-year-old kids now and think, my gosh, I was talking to my pilot last night on the telephone. He lived in New York City. He was 22 years old, charge of 10 people. I was 20, and the safety of the flight of not running into mountains or anything was up to me, and I was only 20 years old. And the responsibility we were given, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Makes a man out of you in a hurry.
Oh, yeah. You grew up real
quick. Yes. Anyway. You were a second lieutenant at that point?
Yeah, I became second lieutenant. the war was winding down, Europe had shut down, and so they had flight crews running out their ears, didn't know what to do with them. I spent an awful lot of time at home on leave or coming home for weekends because I was an instructor at Hondo, Texas, the navigational school for about 3 months, and then was sent to Boise, Idaho, Gowan, to be put on a flight crew, and we were there 5 months in crew training. And July came around, March, April, May, June, be about 3 months flight training. July came around, and they still didn't know what to do with us, so they sent us to Walla Walla, and I was there a couple of months, and the war was over. We had orders to ship out on Saturday, and VGA Day was on Thursday. Friday got in overseas shots, and Friday or Saturday said, guys, take off, the war's over, and within a month I was discharged in October. So that was my military.
Not bad.
It was a delightful career, and I have no unpleasant memories of mm-hmm. my military. Mm-hmm. Then I came back to Grand. I said went to Eastern for a year and a half, five terms, and got they gave certificates, junior certificates, and I took business administration. I thought maybe I might be an accountant, and I went on down to the University of Oregon. By then I met Dorothy, and we got married in December of 46, and we went down to university, and I went there four terms, graduated in June of 48. Well, I'd worked for Montgomery Ward's to work my way through both high school and college, and so I got an offer from Montgomery Ward's to get into management training program, and they were paying the people on the floor about $165 a month, and I was paid $225 a month, which was a pretty good salary then. And in 9 months, having gone to college, I was smart enough to know that Montgomery Ward's was a dying organization, so I bailed out, and I went to work for the state of Oregon in the employment division, and wound up assistant manager in the Salem office. And my boss, at least once a week, would say, George, if I was a young man, I'd go to work for Social Security Administration. They're hiring. They pay so much better, so much benefits. So in January 5th of 1955, I went to work for Social Security Administration.
What were the attitudes that you were aware of toward Social Security at that time?
It was a matter of education. In about a year and a half, I became a field rep there in Salem. And two or three nights a week, we would spend giving talks to farm groups, which just brought in the self-employed people and farmers. There was quite a bit of resistance. But I always said I never saw widow that didn't like Social Security.
Do you know what the basis for the resistance was?
Oh, it was a tax that they felt wouldn't work, government program. We never heard of overtime in those days. Right now they're suing Walmart for not paying overtime, but we'd put in 10-12 hours a day, and they were never going to set overtime. I was a field rep there in Salem. I'd go down to Corvallis, maybe have a dinner at a Grange Hall and give a speech, and get out of there at 10, drive back to Salem. It'd be midnight when we get home, go back to work at 8 o'clock the next morning.
As a field rep, were you essentially promoting Social Security?
Yeah, that was, we were both enforcing, promoting, and taking claims. There was a huge mass of people coming under Social Security, and if you were 65 years old in 1960, you only needed six quarters of coverage. So in 2 years, we had a huge, and we would go to the different towns. My three communities were Newburgh and Minnville and Corvallis. And we'd get there in the morning and maybe work on 5, 6 o'clock at night, huge lines of people waiting to sign up. We're getting Social Security cards. Biggest problem was getting farmers to get Social Security numbers from their employees, and spent days I wasn't out of contact, staying 2 days a week going to the farmers and seeing if they'd gotten the Social Security number, where this person was, and so they could get the credit for it. The farmers would report wages because they had to and pay tax on it, but they didn't have the guy's Social Security number, so they couldn't credit it. So we spent a lot of time in educating the farmers how to report. Always had a very, feeling of accomplishment and helping people in Social Security. Educating them, signing up the widows for widows benefits and children for their, when their fathers were. And we had public relations was were number one key. And then when I retired in 1983, they cut out all the contact stations. They don't even have phone numbers listed. If you call the Social Security office, you may talk to some southern gal in Atlanta, Georgia, and after I worked 4 years in Salem as a field rep, I'd gotten into management or supervisor training, and I became a supervisor in Portland in September of 1961. My regional manager had been a manager in Grand Oregon, Lauta, and I said to him, how do I get to be where I want to be? And he said, well, anybody that has a stripe more than you, tell him. I said, okay, John, I want to be manager in Grand Oregon someday. He said, I'll do my best to get you. That's a wonderful place to be. And I only worked as supervisor 9 months in Portland when boss, in fact, we were moving from Salem to Portland that day, and he came out the house, and I thought, gee, that's nice, coming to see me. He said, don't unpack, you're now the new assistant manager in La Grande, Oregon. And I was teaching a training class of new employees, and so I said, well, I'll finish this training class, and then I'll go. So 6 weeks later, we came to La Grande, and I was assistant manager here for 10 years. We had 18 employees. We had everything from Arlington to Milton Freewater to the Nevada border to Ontario.
Where was the office at that time?
The office was always in La Grande.
Where?
It first started out there in the medical clinic. There's a little building on their property that we had it there, and we outgrew it. And
what property?
Of the J Street Medical Clinic there. Where Dr. Allen was, and I don't know who all the doctors were, but they had a little building there that
across from the university.
Yeah, right across from the
university. On 6th.
Yeah, it was there. Mm-hmm. I came here in July of 62. Yeah, and they were in the process of building a new building, so that was at 1804 4th Street.
Who's they?
The government, Social Security Administration was, GSA, and I helped design the building. It's now, we moved in there January 1st of 63, and we're the main tenants there. There were insurance offices and optometrist offices in the same building, quite as the white building there that now the physical therapy center is.
I believe Elmer Perry built that building.
No, he didn't.
No?
No. It was,
maybe I'm thinking of a different one.
No, the contractor came out of Salem, and he got mostly out of town. Elmer might have worked, I don't remember.
This is the building on 4th.
4th and Main.
Yes.
Fourth and
yes.
Main.
He said he worked on that.
Yeah, he might have, but the main contractor was from out of town.
He gave me the misleading impression that he had the main responsibility.
Well, I don't remember him doing it. He could have. So anyway, then 10 years I was the manager there, retired, and I became the district manager. And I
would you pause there for a moment and describe some of your daily duties in that role as assistant manager?
Oh, my manager was an older fellow, and I pretty well ran the office. I supervised the field, did all the reports, wrote all the memos, supervised the employees in the office. And then when we would get someone be off, I would spend a lot of my time out on the road in public relations. I would go with the we'd send a field rep, say, to Ontario. I'd go with him and help him at the contact station, and then I'd go visit. I knew every accountant, CPA, every funeral director, every newspaper editor in my five counties. And so I spent probably half my time out of the office on the road. We did a lot of radio programs at that time. KLBM would carry a 5-minute spot announcement, and we would pick one small topic and explain that part of it. And so it was going out the radio station and maybe taping up a month or two tapes for them. And we did that in McGrand and Baker in Ontario and John Day.
What kind of information about Social Security were you conveying that way?
Well, just a variety of the responsibility of a homeowner if they hired a housekeeper, reporting their Social Security and how to do it, or maybe just getting your Social Security card, or the type of benefits payable.
What made you think that you needed to supply that kind of information?
Well, because if you remember past few years, people being nominated for some high political position, and they found out they never reported Social Security for their housekeeper or their yard man, and they didn't get selected because of that
trouble.
Violation.
Yes.
Yeah. One nice thing we didn't have to collect the taxes. All we did, Internal Revenue responsibility, was collect the Social Security tax. And if we'd find a violation, someone who had not, we would get the wage slip. The employee would come in and file for benefits. There'd be a gap in his employment. Well, I worked for so-and-so, and they didn't report it. So we would get his W-2s and make photocopies and fill out a form, mail it to IRS, and we would immediately give them credit for that work because they had proof, and then IRS was responsible to go collect the taxes. We gave out the money. They collected it, so we were the good guys.
Were you encountering a lot of angry people or people with complaints?
Oh, some. Basically, no. Social Security was government in those days, 60s and 70s. Government had a good respect, and I ran a friendly office. The thing that bothers me is the post office here. Have you ever met the postmaster there?
No.
No, I haven't either. When my office there, they're on 4th Street, I had two windows, one that looked out into the work area so I could keep track of what's going on, and one that looked out in the reception area. And if there'd be more than two people waiting, I'd get up and go out and wait on people. And filed many a claim myself, I remember one day a woman walked in, she went past the receptionist, came in, sat down in my office, said, "Well, I'm here." I didn't even know her. And I said, "Oh, who are you?" And she told me, "Oh, yeah, you're Charles' older sister." "Yep, I'm retired. I want to draw my Social Security." So I pulled out an application and I signed her up for Social Security. And
The operation was somewhat informal.
I would say it was informal. I tried to run a very democratic office.
Uh-huh.
I would get if I would, and a lot of my work as an assistant manager and also as manager, when I became manager, we had shrunk in size, shrunk in territory. They opened a branch office in Ontario, where we used to go every week. They opened a branch office in Pendleton, where we went. So we only had, four counties left out of the grant. And so we went from 18 employees maybe down to 10. And
was this primarily because of population shifts?
No, it's because opening the smaller branch offices, cutting out, they cut out like Malheur and Harney County and opened an independent office in Ontario.
They wanted the office to be closer to the people who needed the service?
Yeah. There, when Medicare came along, they felt that the number of employees would explode, and it didn't happen. Computers came along, and the method of processing claims, we would take a claim, we had teletype, we would teletype to Baltimore where records were kept. They would mail out their records, we'd put the record together, type up the award notice, and then we'd send it to San Francisco, what's called the payment center, and they would approve of it, and then notify the Treasury Department to issue the checks. So, but now all that's computerized. They call the record up on their computer, and they answer the questions on the computer, make a printout, have the person sign up, they hit the button, and immediately goes to the Internal Revenue or to the Treasury Department to say, start issuing this person these checks. So the instead of a month to get a claim started, you get started in 1 hour interview.
Yeah.
But a lot of my work was in training the staff. We had during my time we had Medicare come in. I was in the groundwork of getting statistics for that, interviewing people on the medical needs.
Did you handle Medicaid also?
We never handled Medicaid as such. In about 1970, I think it was January 73, the Social Security Administration took over the welfare type payments to the aged and the disabled. And we got the disability program, which was a huge program. And then they call it SSIs, Supplemental Security Income, which we took all the welfare offices from all on the records from offices, those people drawing them, and converted them over to federal benefits. And we had primitive computers, and we had the teletype machine to cut a tape and send the records, and all those records were transferred. That January 1st, they were supposed to start getting the checks from us. Well, out of my 2,000 SSI beneficiaries, 500 did not get a check in January, and about 400 of them didn't get a check in February, and about 350 of them didn't get them in March, and they finally sent me a whole bunch of $100 checks. And I personally had to endorse them. They were counter-endorsed by another employee. And I personally, as manager, had to go and hand-deliver this interim payments to the people who were in the computer and getting them automatically. And a year later, on the 2nd of January, I had, I think, five people that didn't get their check. And I went skiing that day. Where only a year later we had 500 that weren't being paid. This is sideline, one of the funniest stories. One of the managers in New York City, that morning he walked out of his office. People had come in because they hadn't gotten their checks, and they were about three blocks long, and he walked to the end of this line of people and kept on walking, went home and sent in his resignation. He quit. It was a mess. And so it was training the staff on how to do new procedures, and I always enjoyed as we went into the computer age. I was always good at math, and I got on a committee out of regional office. There were about five of us, and our job was to prepare training documents to train people in the new computer systems. So I thoroughly enjoyed that.
How did you yourself learn how the computer systems worked?
Oh, just read it. We would be sent to, the managers and one employee would be sent off to, say, to Portland or Seattle for this training. And I put together a training film, a slide tape presentation, and I got a $100 reward for doing it. And it was a graphic demonstration of how to do it.
You make it sound as though your service to the U.S. government was mostly enjoyable.
Yeah, I enjoyed it thoroughly. The one part of Social Security I did not enjoy was the disability claims. I didn't enjoy SSI. It's like the little boy that walked down the fresh sidewalk, concrete sidewalk, made tracks, and the cement man bawled him out. Someone said, "You don't like kids." He says, "Well, I like them in the abstract, but not the concrete." And Social Security is very, very, very concrete. You had this much earnings, you were this age, and this was your benefit. It was black and white. But then you got into SSI and the need, you had to prove your need. You had to have less than $1,500 income. You could own a house, you could have a car that wasn't worth more than $2,000. And we were constantly, every year, checking up on their assets or with the banks to make sure they didn't have more than $1,500. And we found quite a lot of fraud in that, and a lot of innocent. One of my favorite examples, I stopped by, it's about 5 o'clock at night in Mount Vernon, Washington, to help this woman fill out a report, and she had something like $2,000 in the bank. And I said, "Lady, you're not supposed to." "Well, I'm saving money to pay for my funeral." I said, "But you can't have $2,000. I said, "I'm going to go and fill this out this time. I'll be back in 2 weeks. You go down to the funeral parlor and buy your funeral plan, and I'll come back." And I went back, and she had $500. She bought a $1,500 funeral plan. So I had compassion for people. My field reps and myself were well known. There isn't more than five people in the Grand Orient that know who's the manager of Social Security Office. They're invisible. You never see them.
What has caused that?
I think it was they went away from the education because they felt everyone knew about it. We came out of that mode, and it was the using the electronics and the teleservice centers. Phone book is an 800 number, you call them, and they'd have teleservice centers. They felt it was economy. Cutting back on the service. And you know how much service we get out of the post office. They're my pet peeve. I sent a postcard from Portugal a month ago to Dr. Lynn Harris, corner of 3rd and Washington. That's where he is. It came back to my mailbox after I got home saying, "Undeliverable at that address." That's where he is.
I've had that experience numerous times.
Yeah, and at that time I was so well known in town that my brother came to town once. We just moved up here and he didn't know where he lived, and he stopped at the grocery store and he said, "Where's George live?" Stepped out and said, "He lives up that canyon." He didn't even tell me my last name.
Is it your sense that in the effort to cut costs and get better efficiency, these agencies have become so impersonal that they function less well?
Well, they're more efficient, but as far as making government favorable. The Social Security officer has five employees now. and they're harassed and behind in the work and they're snowed under because they've got more work than they can do. And the public is very, well, I used to not, when I first started with Social Security, someone would say, well, what do you do? I didn't like telling them to work for Social Security because they were, it was new and people were getting benefits and they had questions about it and how do I get it and how much will I get and all this. Then my last year or two, I wouldn't tell anybody where I lived because they would practically swear at me. That blank-to-blank government, you know, government had lost faith. I don't know whether it was during the Nixon era. Under John Kennedy, government employees were thought of highly, and then Nixon came along, and we weren't responsible for Nixon.
Tarred by the same brush, though.
Yeah. Now what are we talking about?
Would you like to tell about your letter here with your address label? Post office.
Oh, yeah. Another little incident. This is not for record, but...
not for the record?
I'm just picking on the post office. When I travel, and I travel a lot without Dorothy, I write a diary, quite a detailed diary. Maybe 6 pages. For about every 3 days. And so about every 3 days, I will mail this diary to Dorothy. And I do that up to about a week before I head home. And I use address labels. And I would put the address label to her and then up in the return address be the same label. And the other day, or one of the letters came through, a big stamp on it said, not deliverable at this address, return to sender. And it was the same label, both places. They couldn't deliver it to one place and the other. So I took it in the post office and they said, what happened? They said, well, first he said, how come that's got an airmail sticker on it? I said, because I was in Portugal and I mailed it from Portugal. And they thought, well, maybe it got sent to Baker instead, and they couldn't deliver it to Baker, so they sent it back to LeCrae.
Well, let's talk about your community activities. I know that you have been devoted to La Grande and Union County for all your life, but in later years, what were your activities?
Well, when I came back to La Grande, I felt freely, and we were encouraged, people in management, to be in community activities, so I could do community activities as part of my job during my eight to five hours. And I got into many, many activities. Primarily for 18 years, I was with United Way, and I have found out that if you attend every meeting they have, that before long you're on the board, and before that you're chairman of the board. So I had been here about 5 years when, and working with United Way, I was elected vice president who ran the campaign. And my first year as campaign chairman, we held a big parade. We had a big kickoff. We had the most successful campaign that had up to that time. Comparing the budget then now, it's just ridiculous. But
ridiculous in which direction?
Well, you know, I don't know what our budget was. Say maybe 50,000. Now it's 200,000 or something. And I put together a slide tape presentation And I went around and interviewed all the agencies that were part of United Way, mm-hmm. and had them tell about their program, and I had slides of their activities, and I showed them many, many times. Then the next year when I was elected president, the vice president who was supposed to do the campaign was transferred out of town. So I was stuck without a campaign chairman, so I was both the campaign chairman and the president of it. And I don't know how many years I continued on, like I said, for a total of 18 years with United Way. And I was treasurer for the March of Dimes.
Just before we leave United Way, what were the specific satisfactions for you of working in that area?
Well, it's humanity, helping, you know, the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts and the Red Cross.
Did you keep track somehow of the effects of the United Way contributions?
Oh, I'd say we had good statistics on how many Scouts were helped, how many Girl Scouts. There was a children's program out of Portland that we contributed to. Dorothy and I flew down and visited these state organizations. They no longer here contribute to these state organizations. Everything that's collected is spent in your county. They've done away with it. I immediately became a member of Rotary Club, and Rotary's been most satisfying to me. And it was very beneficial both in my job, because I knew every businessman in Le Grand, and then when I got
there were no business women then?
No, they weren't allowed in Rotary. It was a Supreme Court decision that let them
in. Oh, that's right.
About 10 years ago.
Yes.
But Social Security problem I might come up with, say, JCPenney's or any telephone company or whatever. The manager was a friend of mine through Rotary. And here again, in about 3 years, 1965, I became, I was president of the Rotary Club, attended many state conventions. Dorothy and I, in 73, went to Switzerland, attended an international convention, and then in 85, we attended the international convention in Kansas City. And the thing I like now about Rotary and my travels, I have gone to Rotary clubs in 18 different countries, and I now can get off internet before, like, went to Portugal. I went to internet, got a printout of all the Rotary clubs and where they meet. So while I was in Portugal 3 weeks, I went to two different Rotary clubs, and you get to know the people, and if you have any questions about the community. I remember we went to Switzerland, and I went to Rotary in Biel, which was the watch center of what had more watch manufacturing companies. And I said to the guy sitting there, I'm wanting to buy some watches to take back, about five watches. Which would be the best watch to take? I said, why don't you talk to that guy at the next table? He's the manager of Omega. So I went over and I sat down and I said, hey, I'm wanting to buy some watches. I'm just wondering what would be the best watch. And he said, anything without a Japanese name on it. and then he said, we do not give discounts, any discounts on selling watches. And I said, I'm not trying to get them cheaper, I'm just wanting to know which kind of watch. He said, buy any of them, they're all good. And so I bought about five MIDI watches, and one for Dorothy and one for me, and one for each of my kids, and brought them back. Remember once went to Dundee, Scotland, where Bobby Burns was burned. I went to Rotary there. And after Rotary, about six or eight guys came crowding around me. And where are you heading? Was Edinburgh. Well, you take this back road. You don't go to the main highway. You want to take this back road. And I thought I never was going to get away from those guys talking to them. So it's an excellent contact.
Tell me more about the dynamics of service clubs in Union County.
Most of them are, well, service clubs that are service oriented. I know the Lions Club has their iBank, and I don't know what projects they have. We have a little rivalry between us and Shropness and the Lions Club, and the bell ringing at Salvation Army. We all, one Saturday of the month, one will be at say, Walmart, one will be at Bi-Mart, and one will be at the post office. And the clubs have competition, and you get a recognition from Salvation Army for doing the most of it. Rotary, one of the big projects is international understanding. We receive a student from some other country every year, high school student. They're here for a year, and we send out a student from LeGrand. Our boy now is from, we have a lot from the Philippines, Japan. We have a few from Europe that come. In the district, which is the northern half of Oregon, they have about 60 students that go out. I've worked with them a lot.
During your most active years with service clubs in this area, was there much communication or cooperation among the groups?
Yeah, we would have some joint projects, not necessarily working together. We were always having challenges. Some worthy cause would go to the Lions Club and ask for money, we got into the DARE program, and there is a police car that has DARE written on it, and they go around talking about restraint from alcohol, and the clubs went together and bought this car and got fixed up.
What do you think determines which club any individual might want to join?
Well, I think everybody, in Rotary we have what we call a classification, and you must be either self-employed or be a manager of that, in that business. It's only for managers, the people at management level. Where Lions Club, you could be a salesman for JCPenney, where only the manager of JCPenney could join Rotary. And it used to be, and it's gotten away from it, that the young fellow would join Lions Club when he was a salesperson, then he would become the manager, then he would switch over to Rotary, because that's where all the managers were. And they said that the, I think the joke was that the Lions Club did all the work in the community, and the Rotary Club owned it.
Yes, it sounds to me as though, and this probably isn't unique to this area, a prestige ranking among service organizations.
Yeah, you can't get a liner to admit it, but we've always felt that the Rotary Club was a prestige club. A good example was Dorothy's cousin in Switzerland. He found out I was Rotarian. Oh, Rotarian, oh la la, you're really important, you're really wealthy. But I have found in my travels in the United States, particularly in the small towns, you know, we're just common everyday people. But like when I went to the Noon Club in downtown Lisbon, there were only 15 there that day, and they were all businessmen, executives. I've gone to clubs that where you're sitting next, well, like this guy who is the manager of Omega Watch Company, probably the biggest Swiss watch company. And that it would be the, and I've seen them, well, I went to Rotary in Seattle once, and they had some project, and they went and raised X number of dollars, so they said, everybody's fined $150. Bang, you know, I'd drop out if I was fined $150. And they raised the money in one day. They raised something like $10,000 that day from their membership. But I was sitting that day next to the manager of Beacon Transfer Company. So, I'll throw in back to my United Way program. I did get on the state United Way board, which approved the budget for the, all the state agencies that were in United Way. And for 2 years I was on that board. And I would take a day off on annual leave, take 2 days, drive down to Portland, attend a meeting, pay for my own hotel and my meals, my gas and transportation. And I'd be working with the president of U.S. National Bank and president of First National Bank. They were on expense accounts. But I enjoyed that statement on the state level.
More or less related to that subject, if I can use the term, there's been a professional class in LaGrande in Union County for a number of years, doctors, dentists, attorneys, I suppose, among the most prominent. Do you have any observations about the disconnect or how has this professional class managed itself in relation to other people in the county over the years?
Well, I felt they have, and I can appreciate a doctor being aloof from his patients.
Professional distance.
Yeah, professional distance.
Yes.
And I have not been exposed to any of their social functions. I know they're there. In Rotary Club, we don't have a doctor. We have four or five attorneys, and we have three dentists in it. But as far as the medical profession, mainly because of their schedule, over the years there's been two or three doctors tried to become Rotarians, and they can't get out of the office to come to the meeting, so they can't participate. But I know they're out there, but I know little about them. We have had, over the years, some doctor friends. One couple were part of our social group. He was a GP, and still good friends. But
does it seem to you that doctors, physicians specifically, have been perceived by other people in the county as being the top of the heap, socially and economically?
Well, I have that feeling. They put themselves there. I know as a boy, the only body that's had a college education was the minister and the doctor, and they were held in prestige. And I was aware in high school that the doctors. Children felt they were better than us people who lived on the north side of the track. I grew up on the north side of the track.
Mm-hmm. And people like August Stang, who had quite a bit of money from lumber, timber industry, how was he perceived?
I never knew him.
Or somebody comparable.
Yeah. We kind of called that area of town kind of Snob Hill, but had absolutely no contact with him. I know
he was an unpretentious man, as I recall hearing people say.
Yeah, I know nothing about him. I know his brother-in-law was Kinzel, and he had a son that felt he was a notch above us, and there was the Goss family, and the Bonencamps. They felt they were, I mean, they acted like they were better than us because they had money. And I've never bought a Chevrolet car because of going to school with their children. The Bonencamps have gone in demise as far as and I don't know if there's any living here anymore, but after the mother of the Bonencamp original clan died, she was the runner of the organization, and Bonencamp went down and sold out and no longer in existence. But And there was one doctor's daughter in high school back in 1939. She had a convertible car. The only person in high school had a car, you know, and we thought not too highly of her, mm-hmm. being a snob.
During most of your time in Union County, you have felt the call of the wild, have you not?
Yeah, my father was a farmer and never had time to take me fishing. I never fished, but maybe once, never went camping. And in 1963, I was exposed by a Methodist minister named Boone White that came to Cram. Boone White.
B-O-O-N-E?
Yeah, Boone uh-huh. White. Big fellow out of...
Hadn't heard of him.
Out of... he was here from about 63 to, maybe 70. And he came from Colorado, was a mountain climber. And he gave a talk and showed slides on mountain climbing at Rotary. And he became a Rotarian, was president of Rotary 1 year. And afterwards said, Boone, I want to climb a mountain with you. Just one mountain. Just say you've climbed it. So the next spring he organized, 7 or 8 of us, and we went down and climbed Mount St. Helens, long before it blew. And it was a beautiful, clear day, and on the way back, I looked over at Mount Hood. I said, Boone, take me on Mount Hood. And then I learned about the Mazama Club, and in order to, they had an award system that you work your way up, and their highest award was a 16-peak award climbing all the major peaks from Mount Shasta clear through Mount Rainier. And there were 7 mountains in Oregon, Mount Shasta, and then 8 in Washington to climb. And after climbing them, you got a nice plaque, which I had proudly displayed. And in 35 years of that plaque, I received number 167. So not many people ever stayed in climbing and got their 16-peak award. So 8 or 10 weekends every summer, I would be climbing mountains, and I became known as the Mountain Man. And in doing mountain climbing, I had to buy tents and backpacking gear, because some mountains you'd hike in 5-6 miles to base camp. And then I got into backpacking and discovered the Wallowas. I spent 25 years, I averaged 24 nights of summer in my sleeping bag. And I have gone to I think there's 53 lakes I've gone to in the Wallowas, which is every lake that is on a trail. There are a few little lakes that don't have trails to them. I haven't seen. And then I had some friends from Portland, Olympia, that I hiked with. And we were in the Wallowa, I think we're at Minum Lake. And one night we were sitting around the campfire, and we were a very compatible group. There was about 6 or 8 of us. And we said, hey, let's do this every year. So we said, every year one person will plan a hike, and where will we go? And one of them said, well, I want to do the shoots, and someone gave some other place I wanted to go. And I said, my lifelong dream since I started backpacking was to do the Pacific Crest Trail. So we agreed in about 3 years to do all of Oregon in one stretch. But when time came, we realized that'd be 6 weeks, and no one could get that much time off of work. So we started in 80. We decided to do it in 2 summers, 3 weeks, and I can't remember what I said. In 86, yeah, we did 2 weeks, and we started California border, and hiked 2 weeks that summer, and then the next summer, we finished it up, and in August of 87, we came out the Columbia River. And during that 6-week period, there were 28 different people hiked with us, and only 2 of us did the whole 500 miles. And then I looked at that, it ends at Cascade Lock at the Bridge of the Gods. I looked at that bridge and I said, you know, there's another 500 miles going up to Washington. So over the next about 5-6 years, some years I do 1 week, some 2 weeks.
Do you think your body's better for all that hiking?
Oh, I know it is. I know it is.
Your mind and spirit?
Yeah, and the memories and the slides I've got. On my 70th birthday, on September 7th, 1994, we came out in Canada at Manning Park, and we had a big celebration. And at the celebration party, I said, this is the last, I was always the trail master. Every winter I would, there's a great book called Pacific Crest Trail put up by a guy named Schaefer who has mile-to-mile description. So every winter I'd make up the plan for that section. It could be 60 miles, it could be 120 miles. And I devised my own chart. It'd be the distance we traveled each day, and how many miles you've gone, how many miles you got to go, and how many feet elevation rise or fall. And then I plotted on the map, and Dorothy would have here at home on the bulletin board. She knew where I was sleeping that night. I'd be at this spring or this crossroad.
You were a systematic hiker.
I was very, one of the guys that hiked with me 2 or 3 weeks said I had agenda anxiety. It was my job to get the women out of bed and on the trail, but no later than 9 o'clock. And at our celebration after doing Oregon, he said, the most important person on this hike hasn't gotten any recognition. Said without him, we wouldn't be here today. Because he was the one who saw that we were up and on the trail and we were at the next campground that night.
Do you still hike?
Not as much. The doctor told me my legs were getting old. And this summer I did only one backpack, and that was in up the Zigzag Ridge in on Mount Hood.
If you had access to a global positioning system, would you use it now for your hiking?
I would now, but I have not bought one and probably wouldn't. I would really love it because I always carried an altimeter, and there was one time I know, or a couple of times, where we weren't quite sure where we were, and one place we had to get a campground with only water for 2 days. And I was able to find where we were on the trail by the altimeter. But a GPS would be wonderful.
Certainly the navigator training you got from the U.S. Army helped in all of these activities, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. I'm a good map reader and good sense of direction, except once we were in a storm for about 5 days. And we dropped down off the trail because it said that was the only place there was water. And found out there was water everywhere because it's raining. And we got back up on the trail. That my nephew from Arizona was with me. We kind of went through brush up to your armpits to get back up on the trail. We finally found the trail. I said, okay, let's go. And he was a sailor by hobby. And he was my compass man. And I said, okay, let's go. And I started down the trail. And he said, George, look at your compass. And I was heading south instead of north. And we were supposed to be going north. But
that's embarrassing.
I've always had a great sense of direction, particularly if I had some point, like a mountain or a tower or something to orient me. And I never traveled like when I went to Romania this summer. I carried a compass, and several times, you get in these windy streets in Europe, I grab my compass, oh, well, that's north, and okay, I gotta go this way. I rarely do the house without the compass in my pocket.
If there were to be any major change in life in Union County, let's say in the next 20, 25, 30 years, what would you like to see it be?
think it's pretty nice the way it is.
You don't want change.
I guess a preacher tells us every Sunday at church we're supposed to change and start dancing the aisles, but I don't want to see any great industry coming in. And I had an employee come over from Seattle once, a young fellow raised in Seattle, and took him hiking, and he looked at this meadow and he said, "Boy, this it sure looked beautiful with some high-rise apartments there." And I said, "It sure looked beautiful with some deer and elk running around this meadow."
Let's hope he was being sarcastic.
No, he was serious.
Really?
Yeah, I sent him to Anthony Lakes. I was going to take him. I can find my way. And he went up there by himself on Monday morning. I said, "How'd you like Anthony Lakes?" "Oh, it is really a nice little resort," because he'd been skiing at Magic Mountain and big resort.
He has a developer mentality.
Yeah, he did. He didn't last long for Social Security.
What's the balance between being a reactionary, opposing all change, and being willing to accommodate certain kinds of change?
Well, I wouldn't say we're anti-change. I think I marvel at the computer, and I'm online, and I love internet, and getting any information instantaneously. As soon as you leave, I'm going to see if there's a book in the library I want. And I don't know where we're going, but I wonder and I worry about the still population explosion, where everybody's going to be put. Lisbon was a town of 3 million people, you know, and high-rise apartments for 20 miles stretched out on each way, and the streets crowded, and how are we going to find employment and jobs and housing? It's got to stop somewhere. How are we going to feed them all?
You think the balance is approximately right?